reasonable for your first attempt to try the most earthlike places on Mars. Maybe if this turns out not to detect light, which we don't know yet, we will go to some other place that is more typically Martian. You know, you got to make some assumptions or we can't do anything. Yeah?
What happens
to parachutes? They're cut off 14,000 feet altitude, and they go drifting cheerfully away in the Martian winds, and apparently they drift far enough that they're over the horizon by the time the lander lands, because they look hard for them in pictures and they don't show up. The most interesting hypothesis as to the nature of that shadowing that you saw there at the beginning of the first picture was that the parachute had just happened to drift directly across the sun as seen from the lander, which would be a pretty incredible coincidence. As Tom Young put it when somebody asked him about it, I agree that there is a place on the Martian surface from which the parachute would have hidden the sun. Whether it happened to be the exact place where the lander touched down was a little bit questionable. However, when we got the same shadow the second time, you know, let's say that is really abusing coincidence a little much, especially since the sun was in a completely different direction in the sky for the second landing. The second landing was the Martian equivalent time, 9 a.m. The first landing was about 4 p.m. So, it's dust. Yeah?
How long are the flights in
Martian? Well, I talked about that at some length last week, and the bottom line is we don't know. They're working so well that there's no way to predict when they're finally going to fail, and they'll probably fail piecemeal when they do, rather than some single catastrophic failure. I can name you catastrophic failures, which would cut off the whole spacecraft. For example, the power system fails. But there's no reason to think it's going to happen that way. Wouldn't surprise me in the least if we were getting at least some Viking data right in the 1980s. As a matter of fact, the problem now is not when do the spacecraft run out, it's when do the funds run out. Already they are very severely restricted because of funding cutbacks. They've got about one-fifth of the total number of mission personnel that they had when Lander 1 touched down, and even that was inadequate. And there are just all kinds of things they would like to be able to do and can't because they just haven't got the people to do it. You know, you got these four beautiful spacecraft up there, and about 90% of the capabilities of one lander and maybe 50% of the capabilities of the others are just going to waste. And the orbiters, I don't know the numbers on, but, you know, I'm sure they're comparable to that sort of thing. You get some idiot politician that thinks he's very clever if he finds some way to save 2%, you know, off the budget. And that 2% cuts your data return to maybe a tenth of what it would have been otherwise. I'm not making up that number, I'm thinking of a specific case. It isn't Viking, it's a different one. Other questions? Yeah?
Are there, do you know of any similar or any type of probes that are scheduled in the future for
Indiana? Next major planetary mission is Mariner Jupiter Saturn to be launched this coming year. One on August 20th and one early in September, according to the nominal dates. And that is going to be a really fantastic mission. It may last as much as 12 years, and it will visit at least 16 separate worlds, and maybe more than that. And even 16 is twice as many as we have examined in all of solar system exploration to date. It will take hundreds of thousands of pictures of both Jupiter and Saturn, plus their satellites, at each of the respective approaches. And to give you an idea of the detail, maybe you've seen some of the Pioneer 10 and 11 Jupiter pictures, and, you know, here's a picture, and there's the great red spot taking up a whole quarter of the frame, and it's really impressive. But the MJS pictures at closest approach will be so detailed that it will take hundreds of them simply to fill the red spot. And we'll get something like, what is it, one picture every 12 seconds for 3 months, something like that. Really, really just incredible. And there's some very, very interesting worlds out there, but that's another whole lecture, too. In fact, I already gave it here. But I'll come back and give it again. it's going to be a really neat mission. Now, of course, these are not landings. You know, these are flybys, but that's because these are still unknown worlds. You can't very well send a lander to Titan, for example, which may be, this is maybe 2 or 3 years old, Titan may be the most likely place for life outside the Earth in the solar system, even more than Mars. And, you know, people don't realize that. There isn't a big public enthusiasm for a landing on Titan the way there was for Mars, because Mars has had press agents for 75 years now, everybody from Edgar Rice Burroughs on down, you know, right through to Ray Bradbury, telling people that it was the place for life. And nobody's ever heard of Titan. Arthur C. Clarke has made a good start. He's written his most recent novel about Titan, and got some neat things in it. He does, Imperial Earth, the name of the book. You know, maybe someday people will have heard of Titan also. But you can't land on Titan until you know there's something to land on. At this point, we don't even know that. The whole surface may be just some sort of slush. You know, you can't land on that kind of stuff. That'd be like trying to land in Michigan, you know. But it may literally be a slush. Titan appears to be made mostly of a mixture of frozen water, frozen methane, and frozen ammonia. Rock in very small quantities. You know, so it's not even made of the same substances as the Earth.
Radar doesn't help much, is it?
No, not as edges. It's not a billion miles away. I don't know if they've even gotten a radar return from Titan. They have from the rings. They have not from Saturn itself because there's nothing to return. You know, there's no solid surface. Both Jupiter and Saturn are liquid all the way through, and mostly hydrogen. And ice does not reflect radar very well. And if Titan has an icy surface this way, it wouldn't surprise me if you just couldn't get a radar return from it. If there are chunks of rock sticking through here and there, then that may be another story. The rings have a certain amount of rock in them, so you got to return from them. Of course, we know much more about the rings from Mariner, Jupiter, Saturn, too. That mission is just so incredible. I mean, I could go on for hours about it. They'll do things like fly directly behind the rings as seen from the Earth, which means that the radio signals will travel right through the rings to us, and we'll be able to learn all kinds of things about the rings from that. Get a preview of all that from Pioneer 11, which will arrive at Saturn in 1979. But the Pioneers are nothing like the Mariners in terms of their capability. So it's just going to be an incredible mission. And they'll go to Jupiter and get Jupiter and five of its moons in better detail than the best Earth-based pictures of our own moon. That is, the four big moons plus Amalthea, the very innermost, a little one. And they will go to Saturn, and of the 10 moons, or I guess by now it's 11. I'm not supposed to know, but they just discovered an 11th moon of Saturn. It was supposed to be announced, I think, yesterday. Of those, we'll get something like 7 of the moons, plus Saturn itself, in that kind of detail, and half kilometer resolution on Titan, on the entire disk of Titan. We'll have half kilometer resolution, means you can see everything bigger than half a kilometer across, and a kilometer is about two-thirds of a mile, so we're talking about everything bigger than a third of a mile across, and selective frames, of course, better than that. Half kilometer resolution on Io, too, the innermost of the big moons of Jupiter. And then there is a good chance that Mariner 11, which is the first spacecraft to be launched, but the second one to reach both Jupiter and Saturn, as it turns out, so Mariner 12 gets there first. It's going to be really confusing trying to get people to understand the difference between Mariner 11, Mariner 12, and Pioneer 11. Anyway, particularly since Mariners 11 and 12 will be getting to Jupiter just about the same time as Pioneer 11 is getting to Saturn, and, you know, they're also going on to Saturn, so it's going to be fun. But anyway, Mariner 11 may be sent on to Uranus, and they should be able to get Uranus and probably all five of its moons, and certainly four of the five. And then they're even whispering about sending it on to Neptune afterwards. I'm not supposed to know about that either, but and get Triton at least, and maybe near. I don't think Nereid, but certainly Triton.
Well,
so.
Does anybody at JPL receive it?
Yeah, I think so. NJS doesn't require anything like the funding commitment that Viking did for two reasons. First, elaborate though it is in terms of number of worlds that it's visiting, it's still nothing like the number of bits of data per second, even though they're being sent in at the rate I was talking about. And the other thing is that it's spread out over many, many more years. You don't have the kind of concentration of effort that you needed on Viking. So, you know, you can do the same thing with fewer people spread out over a longer time. I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe it's just my naivete speaking, because I have not talked with anyone at JPL specifically about that question. But I get the impression that they're happier with their NJS funding than they are with their Viking funding. But, you know, I don't know. Of course, it's also hard to get them to complain about their Viking funding, too. You know, you really have to dig this out of them. They don't go around complaining about it quite as much as I think they should. You know, it's their notion of professionalism and not rocking the boat and so forth. And, well, that's fine up to a certain point. after a while, it becomes self-destructive, I think. However, I'm not the world's greatest politician either.
Jim, proposed budget for 1977-78 will be coming out in the
next. As already, for, if you mean for the budget. Yeah. Carter, as far as NASA goes, and as far as most areas of the budget goes, and certainly NASA, which, you know, just is not one of the big controversial major items, Carter is expected to pretty well stick to Ford's budget. And Ford has proposed a $4.0 billion NASA budget. And that is about, it's a good increase, and it's the first genuine increase that we have had in, I believe, 13 years. Every year before this, for 12 or 13 years, it has gone down at least in terms of, once you account for inflation, and most of those years it went down even if you don't consider inflation. So it's not bad. We will get the space telescope. We will have funds for three more shuttles to be constructed, and that's the real bottleneck. Get those shuttles built, and then there will be strong pressures to fly things in them, you know. But that's not the whole story. I mean, we had a whole Skylab mission grounded in storage, bought and paid for already. All we needed was the money to fly it, and couldn't get back. But, you know, at least it's better having them than not. I have not heard anything specifically about Carter's opinions on space. And, of course, this is a question people ask me constantly. And I've tried. I have literally asked everybody from Carl Sagan to NASA public information people, and just nobody knows.
Well, I'm trying from a different source to get information on it. One quick question about the budget.
If you find out anything, you know, appreciate you letting me know. Okay. I tell you this, Mondale, all through his Senate career, was one of the leading opponents of the space shuttle, and the space shuttle was the key to the space program from here on out, you know, from 1980 on. But I have been told by somebody that ought to know, and at least claims to know, and is in a position such that he should know, that Mondale has seen the light on this and changed his mind. He's now pro-space shuttle. And in fact, Jerry O'Neill mentioned in March in Ann Arbor, I asked him whether, you know, there were still 15 million Democratic candidates then, and nobody looked serious, including Carter, because there were too many of them. And I asked him whether he knew the positions of any of the candidates on space colonization. Morris Udall had expressed an interest. So I wondered if anybody else had. And he said, yeah, we got a very nice letter asking more information from Jimmy Carter. And of course everybody said, who? <You know? laughs> Now, I don't know. A letter asking for information is a long way from, here's $100 billion, go build the thing, you know, which is the estimate for the cost of the first one. We get it back in 7 years, and even if we didn't, it's half of what was spent on cosmetics during the same period. The politicians don't think that way, you know. I don't know. I do know that Carter seems to have this thing about wanting to go down in history. Well, the last president we had like that is John Kennedy, and, you know, he created Apollo. And it's a very good way to go down in history. Name me one medieval Spanish king or queen other than Ferdinand and Isabella. And name me one thing that Ferdinand and Isabella did other than support Columbus. Okay? You know, so that's a great way to get remembered in history, but I don't know if he knows that. Well, let's say a hot fluid, because it's denser than some solids by the time you get to the bottom. And so if you say gas, it leaves a kind of misleading impression. If you say liquid, it does too. So if you say fluid, you know, you're being more neutral.
Okay, what is Mars?
Oh, Mars is a rock. Mars is a terrestrial planet, yeah. See, there are terrestrial planets and there are Jovian planets, and they're completely different kinds of bodies. The Jovians are made mostly of hydrogen and helium, and after that, water, methane, and ammonia. The terrestrials are made of whatever substances were solid at their particular distances from the sun when they formed, and that's rock in the inner solar system, and in the outer solar system, like the big moons of Jupiter and Saturn, it's rock plus various ices, and the ices outnumber the rock.
But there's no molten rock like before?
We don't know that. That's one of the things that I'll be able to tell you after we've got more seismic data. There are certainly enormous volcanoes, but remember the lava from volcanoes, at least on Earth, does not come from the core, as so many people think. It comes, most of it comes from either the very top of the mantle or even within the crust itself. And it's melted by local processes that are quite close to the surface. There is no known case of a rock that has actually come from the core, with the possible exception of one very, very controversial specimen, which one paper has claimed is from the outer core and was brought up by a really complex process that would be very, very unusual. It's kind of neat how they discovered that one, too. It's metallic, of course, which is what gave them the idea. And this graduate student at Columbia University was prowling through the storeroom in the geology museum one day, and he came across this funny-looking glob of stuff which had no information about whatever except a label that said, this is not a meteorite. So he started investigating, and he claimed the sample from the outer core. But, you know, with that one rare and controversial exception, there are a lot of people that won't swallow that. Lava is from the outer part of the planet, at least on Earth. And even from the moon, the lava is from deeper, but probably no more than a few hundred miles. So the fact that there has been volcanism on Mars is not really related to the question of whether it's got a molten core, which is what you asked. Now, a possible indirect way of answering that would be the fact that Mars has no magnetic field, or if it has one, as the Russians have reported, it's a very, very tiny one. And to have a magnetic field on a planet, you do not, contrary to popular belief, need a metallic core. What you need is a molten core. It can be rock and give you a fine magnetic field, but it could be pure alnico, which is what they make the best magnets of, and if it were solid, it would not be a magnet. A planet is not a permanent magnet, it's an electromagnet. What generates the magnetic field on a planet is large-scale motions within a fluid core, which contains electrically charged material, if it's a molten metal or molten rock, it will, and large-scale motions of electrically charged material constitute a current, and an electric current generates a magnetic field, and that's where the Earth's magnetic field comes from. It is not a permanent magnet. The fact that our core is metal is totally irrelevant. It's so hot that a permanent magnet would have lost its magnetism way below the temperature of the core. You heat a magnet, it's not a magnet anymore. And you've only got to heat it up to about 800 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a temperature called the Curie point. Well, even the outer core of the Earth is several thousand degrees Fahrenheit. See, we're in all kinds of things, but it's going to be a lecture about Mars. Or about the Earth. Yeah?
Do you have any kind of information about the satellite you were talking about?
Yeah, suppose it would have been discovered. It is in about the same orbit as Janus, which is the innermost. That's the most recent we discovered one before this. And there are some people that don't believe in Janus, you know.
None of those names are official.
Yeah. Even the names for the small moons of Jupiter have now been made official by the International Astronomical Union, but not the set that a lot of people were using for a long time. They got a completely new set, and they made those official. Last year, I think it was. Maybe the year before. Hard to keep track of these IAU meetings. It would have been the year before. Yeah, because there's one coming up. I'm sorry, scratch that. I think it was this year. But if it was the year before, I won't be surprised. Okay, let's take one more question, because we all got to go to bed sometime. Yeah?
How many cameras are in each Viking?
There are two cameras on each lander, and two cameras on each orbiter.
Okay.
The two on each of the landers is so you can have stereo pictures. The two on each of the orbiters is so you can take twice as many pictures.
Okay, does that scan full 350 degrees?
On the lander, yes. Not that it always does, but you can make it do so when you want. And the orbiter takes a fixed frame, which is only 1.5 degrees on a side. It's quite a strong telephoto lens, about the equivalent of 1,000 millimeter if you have a 35 millimeter camera. They don't have a wide-angle lens on the Viking orbiters. That's a wide-angle mapping sort of thing, and Mariner 9 already did that very, very well. What the Viking orbiters are about is detailed pictures of especially interesting areas. And so both cameras are that highly detailed. And the Mariner Jupiter Saturn cameras are going to be the same sort of thing. I don't know if they're the same camera or not, but, you know, also very highly detailed pictures. And that means that your full disk pictures of Jupiter are going to be taken like 3 weeks out, and the pictures taken really close in will be very, very highly detailed.
Is every picture we're receiving stereoscopic?
From the landers? None of the pictures we're receiving is stereoscopic per se. You cannot operate both lander cameras simultaneously. So you take the left frame one day and the right frame maybe 3 weeks later and add them together in whatever combination you want. So we have stereo coverage of the entire field of view visible to both landers now. But it's not as though it was obtained on a single day. The lander cameras can take pictures that are black and white. They can take them in color. If they are in black and white, they can be, although they do not have to be, four times as detailed, four times the resolution as the color pictures are. And if they, but there's also a survey mode in black and white to take the picture as rapidly as possible, because the color picture takes three times as long to take as the black and white picture. And they can also take pictures in several infrared wavelengths, and from those, false color images can be made up where a particular visible color represents a particular infrared color. And there is a final capability, which is that they can image the sun. It can quite a long way from Apollo 12 when Pete Conrad accidentally pointed the camera at the sun and thereafter there wasn't a camera. Now we're doing it on purpose. Okay, people, thank you very much, and I hope to see you all next week. Next week is... Here, and I'm here, but people are still coming in. Why don't we use this for any questions that you might have generated from the last two lectures that I didn't answer, perhaps. Yeah?
Could you go a little more on what the planned explorations of the Martian moons will be in years?
Okay, I'll repeat the questions for you. A little more detail on planned explorations of the Martian moons. Basically, you want to attack it in two different ways. Well, from the orbiter from the lander. And the orbiters, Viking Orbiter 1 has just been put through the first of a series of maneuvers to change its orbit so that toward the end of February, it will fly only 36 miles from the surface of Phobos, which is the inner of the two Martian moons. And Phobos is about 15 miles across, and so this means about two Phobos diameters away. There will be a series of close approaches on successive days, of which one is the closest of all, and you'll get good pictures on the outer days there. On the innermost one, you're so close that it would smear, but get some very spectacular close-up pictures in the outer days. And on the innermost day, when it's closest, you'll have a flyby that is so close that Phobos gravity will affect the orbit of the spacecraft by a detectable amount. Therefore, we can measure the strength of Phobos gravity, and therefore how heavy Phobos is, and therefore figure out what it's made of. It turns out there are only two really good possibilities for what it could be made of, and both of those are very interesting and exciting, and if I had about 15 minutes, I could go through that whole story with you. But suffice it to say that they can be differentiated from one another quite easily on the basis of density. One is a good deal less dense than the other. Okay, the other attack is to observe them from the surface with the landers, and again, try to find out what they're made of, this time by taking pictures of them in infrared wavelength, which the lander cameras are sensitive to, and which can be used to determine particularly the amount of iron that is present in the minerals of the substance of the thing that you're looking at. And those infrared capabilities were put in mainly to study the Martian surface, but they'll also be usable for Phobos. And I don't know, I got the book of abstracts for the Division of Planetary Sciences meeting of the American Astronomical Society, which was just held in Honolulu. And unfortunately, since it was in Honolulu, I couldn't be there. It's a little expensive, but I could use Honolulu climate at this time of year. In that book of abstracts, there was a note about how they had observed Phobos from the landers in, quote, seven spectral regions, end quote, which would have to include infrared, because there just aren't that many in the visible. And I said, huh? Because I'd always heard of this as being something that they were going to do. And the last time that I talked to Cal Broom, the mission director, which was yesterday, I asked him, I said, have they taken pictures of Phobos from the surface already, from the landers? And he said, not that I'm aware of. So this has been done, nobody told me, and nobody told the mission director. Okay, so that's the summary, more or less. And of course, the other thing that they'll try to do is keep mapping them. Yeah?
Both of the orbiters are... approximately 900,000 miles out.
No, 900 miles.
Is there any intention to bring one or the other of those orbiters into a much closer orbit, and if so, why not?
Question is, both of the orbiters have a closest approach to Mars of about 900 miles, and is there any intention to bring either or both of them closer to Mars, and if so, why not?
orbit, by the way, is quite eccentric. It's like this. And at the near end, you're about 900 miles above the surface, and at the far end, you're 20,200 miles above the surface. And there are several reasons for that, one of which is that it turns out that to get a circular orbit would have required more fuel than they had, and the other of which is that that way you can take near-in pictures and far-out pictures, which are less detailed, but show you a bigger region of the planet, so you can tie together what you're seeing from near-in. Now, the reason that that 900-mile periapsis height is the closest height, the reason that was chosen at first was that the orbiter cameras do not have image motion compensation. That is, you don't have a capability if the thing that you're taking the picture of is moving, well, you're moving or it's moving, in this case, of course, you're moving, the spacecraft is moving, during the exposure, if you really want really good, precise, high-resolution photography, you move your film or you move your entire camera in order to compensate for that motion, which even during the fraction of a second of the exposure can become significant. Well, building an image motion compensation in the camera is expensive, and they were very severely strapped for funds, and so that was one thing that they didn't have. Well, the closest you could get and take good pictures with full resolution and not have the image smear during the photography was in fact 900 miles. However, after the mission was already underway, in fact after the orbiters were already in orbit, someone got the idea of taking advantage of the fact that the cameras are mounted together with the other two scientific instruments on the orbiters on a platform which can be moved around so that you can aim it at a particular place on Mars that you are looking at. You're not restricted to whichever way the orbiter happens to be facing. You know, you can move it around a little bit. And they got the idea of moving the camera platform during the exposure. Now, this is something that's never been designed for, but there are two rates at which it can be moved, and those correspond, of course, to two possible rates of image motion. And so they tried it to take pictures of Phobos, and it worked brilliantly. They made five tries, of which two were successful, and those two, especially one of them, showed Phobos with something like 150-foot resolution. In other words, you could see everything bigger than 150 feet across. So then they said, well, hey, wow, tremendous. If you can do this with Phobos, we can do it with Mars. So they calculated the height above the Martian surface at which each of the two image motion rates would compensate for the motion of the spacecraft relative to Mars. And one of those turned out to be about half of that 900 mile height, in other words 400 miles, and the other about a third of it, about 300 miles. And I'm sorry, that can't be right because it's 300 kilometers, so that would be 200 miles, which of course is really, really close in. And yes, in fact, that's right, because it's five times as good resolution as they thought they were ever going to be able to get. So, Viking Orbiter 2 was lowered just after conjunction, just after Mars came out from behind the Sun, to a height, to the upper of those two heights. They started out with the easier one to be conservative. And they started taking pictures, and every one of the pictures was blank. And the reason turned out to be that unbeknownst to the Viking scientists and engineers, the North Polar Hood had formed right in the latitudes where the periapsis was over, in other words, right in the latitude where you are closest to Mars, during conjunction when we couldn't see it. And, you know, real dirty trick pulled on us by nature. The North Polar Hood is the cloud, is the cap of clouds which appears over whatever pole is going to have winter a few months later. Autumn has just begun in the northern hemisphere of Mars. Generally, the hood begins a little bit after the beginning of autumn. This year, it was early. And so you have this cap of clouds, which develops in the air a few months before the air begins to freeze and fall on the ground, and you get the frozen carbon dioxide polar cap in the winter. And so what we've got is lots of nice, spectacular, close-up, detailed pictures of the North Polar Hood, which are absolutely no use to anybody because they're so close-up and so detailed that even the meteorologist can't use them. You know, a really magnified picture of a cloud is not terribly useful. So that was really a shame because the maneuver to change the orbit was a difficult one and was carried out brilliantly. And, you know, to have something like that happen is really a shame, particularly since Sorry?
Are they
going to leave it there? Okay, the point is they've got to. Because the funds have been cut so badly, and therefore the personnel has been cut so badly, that they simply cannot spare the people required to do the calculations and feed up the commands and so on to get it up into a higher orbit. And so they are simply, the orbiter people, the orbiter engineers, are and have been for more than a month essentially exclusively tied up with the Phobos maneuvers on the other orbiter, Viking Orbiter 1. And so Orbiter 2 has just had to be left that way, and they can't even change the photographic sequences. It would be desirable scientifically to say, all right, we're getting all these useless pictures of periapsis, let's throw those away and start taking all of our pictures of other areas from farther out, you know, and at least get something. And they can't even do that. They are still grinding through photographic sequences, most of which were periapsis coverage, that were designed way back in December when we didn't even know the polar wave was forming. And it'll be several months before they'll be able to do anything about that. So every periapsis, the orbiter goes down there, carries out this incredible maneuver that was never designed for, of moving the cameras, the whole camera platform during the exposure, and sends back one after another completely useless pictures. And that's what's been happening there, simply as a result of these funding cutbacks. Okay, now Viking Orbiter 1 has a periapsis at a much lower altitude, a much lower latitude, much closer to the equator, only 17 degrees north. And that is not going to ever be affected by the North Polar Hood. So they had been thinking all along of lowering its periapsis even further, maybe all the way down to 200 miles. There is a problem with that, however, and that is that the international treaty, which requires that Mars may not be contaminated for 50 years after the date of signing of the treaty by any organisms carried from Earth, means that if you have an unsterilized spacecraft, such as the orbiters are, they're not sterilized the way the landers were, you are not allowed to put them into any orbit or to, which is capable of decaying within 50 years, and they're conservative, they actually shoot for 300 years, and also you are not allowed to undergo any maneuver with an unsterilized spacecraft which has the capability of impacting the planet if the worst possible thing should go wrong and the engine should refuse to shut off when it is supposed to and should burn to completion, or anything short of that. Okay? In other words, you not only can't undergo a maneuver which would impact the planet intentionally, you cannot undergo one which could impact the planet if anything at all went wrong. And the worst thing that could go wrong is a burn to completion, so that's what you calculate. And it looked as though the only way that they were going to be able to do it was to bring it to about the same height as Orbiter 2, actually a little bit lower. The image motion compensation rate at that latitude isn't quite the same because Mars is rotating more rapidly at that latitude, and it's partly a matter of Mars's motion, partly a matter of the spacecraft's motion. So they would have brought it back down to about 450 miles, and then it looked for a while as though they couldn't even do that because the only way they could get there would be to use up almost all the remaining fuel in the orbiter's tank. They could have done it much more efficiently than that. However, it turned out the burns that would have been more efficient would have had a probability of impacting the planet if there were a burn to completion, and you're not allowed to do that. However, just today, Cal Broom, in fact, called me back because I've been talking to him about this yesterday, and he said, have you broadcast that thing we said yesterday? And I said, no, because I'm doing a series of reports, and it happened, I put that at the end. And he said, it looks as though we've got a way of bringing it all the way down to 300 kilometers, which is 200 miles. And the way I could tell you about, but it's very complicated, it involves all kinds of technical things that operate with a spacecraft. The point is, it looks as though they've got a sneaky way of getting around the whole problem. And so, that's a long answer to a short question, but it looks as though somewhere around the beginning of March, we may be getting pictures from as close in as 200 miles, and that means five times the detail we thought was going to be the theoretical limit, and that means 50-foot resolution on the surface of Mars. That's going to be pretty good. And furthermore, we should be able to get pictures of that resolution, or very close to it, of the Viking Lander 1 site, because that is practically at the periapsis latitude. It's further north, but not so much further north that your resolution is really severely degraded. So that should be nice. Because so far, it's been impossible to figure out where on the orbiter pictures the lander is sitting. The biggest crater on the lander pictures visible anywhere, you know, on the whole horizon, is smaller than the resolution than a single resolution element in the orbiter pictures. And so, you know, it's kind of frustrating. We don't know where we landed. We've got a perfectly good latitude and longitude as to where we landed from radio tracking data, but the latitude and longitude grid isn't that well fixed with respect to the things you actually see on the orbiter pictures. And what you got to be able to do is say, yeah, here, this crater right here is this one in the orbiter picture. And we can't do that. They aren't big enough. But with this kind of resolution, we'll be able to do it. Okay, let's get on and talk about the Martian atmosphere then. And if we could have the lights down and the first slide, I would like to undergo a brief digression at the very beginning. I'll leave aside the philosophical question of whether it is a digression that happens at the very beginning, and consider why it is that we used to think we knew more about Mars than we did. I made the remark the first day that our previous knowledge of Mars, our pre-1971 knowledge of Mars, 1971 being the date of Mariner 9, was so different from what the real planet turns out to be that it was essentially science fiction, and the real Mars is so different from what we thought it was that we realized we did not even know how little we knew about Mars. And that's the worst possible situation you can have in science. You're much better off if at least you know you don't know. Well, here's the reason that we didn't know very much about Mars from the Earth. This is a picture that was taken on a very special day in 1911, I think it was, anyway, early in this century, when Mars was about to be covered over by the Moon as seen from the Earth. And so Mars is sitting right next to the Moon in the sky. This is the Moon on the right, and this little tiny thing that you see over here at the left edge of the picture is the entire disk of Mars. And I think you can see that there is more detail to be seen in even a medium-sized lunar crater, for example Tycho, than there is on the entire surface of Mars as seen from the Earth. Mars, of course, is actually bigger than the Moon, in fact, twice its diameter, but it's also, at best, 150 times farther away. And so, with our best telescopes, as seen from the Earth, we can see about as much detail on the surface of Mars, in terms of resolution, the number of miles across we can see, as you can see on the naked eye on the Moon. With the naked eye on the Moon from Earth, you can see everything bigger than 50 miles across, and on Mars with our best telescopes from Earth, the figure is only 25 miles. So we didn't know very much about Mars. And if I can have the next slide, you'll see the effect of that. The pictures here are more or less typical pictures of Mars taken through Earth-based telescopes, and they are therefore, she's trying to focus the slides. This is the wrong one to focus on, because the whole point of this is that there's almost nothing that you can see. But if you focus on the dust, you're going to do your best, I think. Those are sharp, as a matter of fact. That is as sharp as you can get that slide, and that's the whole point. These are pictures of a sort I doubt you have ever seen before, because the ones that are shown in the astronomy textbooks and in lectures like mine and so on are generally the very, very best ones. These are much more typical. And here is this entire world, 4,000 miles across, and I think you can see there are a few fuzzy dots on it, and that's it. Furthermore, these two pictures, and you'll notice one of them is much better than the other. They're both lousy, but one is better than the other. Those two pictures were taken only a few minutes apart. The problem is that the Earth's atmosphere is never still. Everybody has seen stars twinkling with the naked eye, and they're doing it quite nicely out there tonight. And it's a very pretty phenomenon unless you happen to be an astronomer and you're trying to look at things magnified several hundred times through a telescope, and then it becomes really one of the most serious problems in astronomy. It is called seeing in astronomy, and the seeing varies quite a lot. It is turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere, which, as I say, is never still. It is so bad that a 20-inch telescope in Earth orbit, or anywhere above the Earth's atmosphere, for example on the Moon, where you don't have the seeing problems, can see better resolution than the biggest telescope on Earth, the 236-inch that the Russians have just finished, or our own biggest, the 200-inch out of Mount Palomar. So these are typical pictures, and the seeing does vary, and very, very occasionally you get a moment, just a moment, maybe out of hours, when it just so happens the air path you're looking through steadies down for just a moment, and then you can see all kinds of detail which you cannot see before and you cannot see after, and therefore usually you can't photograph. And for that reason, you can see more on a planetary disk than you can photograph, but only for a fleeting moment. And so you're never quite sure that it was there, and you're also never quite sure the effect to which all of the complex optical illusions and other perceptual problems, I'll use the word here since it becomes a problem, connected with the way the human eye and brain operate are doing to you. You're never quite sure whether the things you're seeing are real or something else. And of course the prime example of that is the famous Martian canals, which turn out, in fact, to be nothing but optical illusions. Let's go on to the next slide. And here is a picture which I've deliberately put in upside down. Don't worry, Donna, that's correct. Because in those days they printed the pictures with south up, and you're probably happier with north up, and so I did it that way. And what it shows you is the reason for most of the wrong features of the classical view of Mars. Mars was thought to have much more atmosphere than in fact it does during the classical period. And, in fact, people were getting as enthusiastic as quoting values as dense as the atmosphere of Earth. And even the pessimistic values were something like 10 or 15% as dense as Earth's atmosphere. In fact, the correct number is 0.5%. Well, excuse me, it turns out that if you think the planet has more air than it does, everything else that you think about it is going to be wrong. And the reason that I am introducing the difference between the classical picture of Mars, which after all most of you probably still have in your minds because it's only a few years old, and unless you've really been following these things very, very closely, you know, even a relatively up-to-date person is going to have a five-year out-of-date notion, which is completely wrong in the case of Mars. And the reason for introducing the differences here is that in order to explain why we could be so badly wrong, it turns out to be an atmospheric matter, and this, of course, is the atmosphere lecture. Well, here's the reason for it. These are pictures of Mars taken through various colored filters. And the red ones and the orange ones, you know, show lots and lots of surface detail, and the blue one up there shows almost no surface detail. That is exactly the effect that you would expect if the planet had a great deal of air. Because if you, anybody knows who has tried to take black and white pictures of distant scenes on Earth, if you want to penetrate the haze which is produced by an atmosphere, the phenomenon called Rayleigh scattering, exactly the same thing produces our blue sky, it is much more effective for short wavelengths like blue than it is for long wavelengths like red and orange. And if you want to penetrate that haze, you take your picture through a red filter. And on the other hand, if you want an atmospheric effect, if you want to accentuate the fog, then you take your picture through a blue filter. Well, when you take pictures through blue filters and red filters on Mars, you can see the kinds of effects that you get, blue there in the upper left, red in the lower left, and it certainly looks as though Mars has a great deal of air. In addition to that, we can find out what a planet's air is made of by using a device called the spectroscope, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. If you're not familiar with it, don't worry about it. All that matters is how we find out what things are made of, what astronomical bodies are made of, if they are gaseous, and that includes atmospheres. And it turns out, for technical reasons that I won't bore you with, that the spectroscope is very efficient at detecting carbon dioxide. It's very easy to detect carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of another planet from the Earth, and it's almost impossible to detect nitrogen. So, they looked at Mars, and they found there was a little tiny bit of carbon dioxide in Mars's atmosphere. And to make matters worse, the early observers even overestimated the amount of carbon dioxide they were seeing, so they were getting several percent of the Earth's atmosphere worth of carbon dioxide. And then they said, okay, we know that Mars got all this extra air, and there must be something there that we can't detect. Nitrogen is the commonest gas in the Earth's atmosphere, and oxygen, of course, is second. The oxygen is due to photosynthesis, so who knows whether another planet ought to have a lot of oxygen, but at least it ought to have a lot of nitrogen in its atmosphere, and so Mars probably has, in addition to the little bit of carbon dioxide that we can detect, a lot of nitrogen which we cannot. That turned out to be a disastrous atmosphere, and so Mars probably has, in addition to the little bit of carbon dioxide that we can detect, a lot of nitrogen which we cannot. That turned out to be a disastrous line of reasoning. I think it's a perfectly plausible line of reasoning. If you don't know what other planets are like,
The most reasonable way, surely, is to proceed on the assumption that they're the way you are. And if Earth's atmosphere is mostly nitrogen, presumably Mars' would be also. It turns out that, in fact, Earth is a freak case as far as atmospheres go. The atmosphere of a planet such as ours ought not to be mostly nitrogen. It ought to be mostly carbon dioxide. The only reason that we don't have an atmosphere consisting almost exclusively of carbon dioxide is a whole series of rather unlikely coincidences that happened in the history of the Earth, including the development of life here. And if I have time at the end of the lecture, I'll tell you that story. It's a very interesting one. I'm just not quite sure how much atmospheric stuff I can fit in for you today. Let's see if that did indeed work. Ah, right, tremendous. Good, we're back in business. Thanks, Donna. The situation is that Mars' atmosphere, in fact, should be mostly carbon dioxide, and so the bottom line is that little tiny bit of carbon dioxide they were detecting was, in fact, all of the air that Mars has. There wasn't all the nitrogen. So they said, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? And that is a really dirty trick which nature pulled on us. Einstein said something about God is subtle, but he is never malicious. If he had seen some of the recent findings in planetary science, I really wonder whether his faith and all that sort of thing wouldn't be shaken. It turns out that in that upper left picture, taken in blue light, you are not seeing an atmosphere at all. You are seeing right down to the surface. It's just that in blue light, the surface features happen to show almost no contrast. Here's what I mean by that. These bright areas are red in color. They are the famous red deserts, and they're what give Mars its reddish color as seen from the Earth. The dark areas for many, many years were believed to be green, and that was just taken for granted. It was in all the astronomy textbooks. Dark areas of Mars are green. As a matter of fact, they are not green. It was shown only a few years ago by observations from the Earth that they are almost colorless, they're practically gray, and what little bit of color they do have is in fact very slightly in the red direction, but they're almost gray. And that green was a psychological effect. Anybody knows that if you take a really strong patch of color, for example red, and put gray next to it, the eye thinks that it sees the complementary color in that gray. It sees the gray as green. And we were having exactly that optical illusion as we looked at Mars. And it was an enormously important illusion because the green color was taken together with other evidence, which I'll show you in a moment, as evidence that these dark areas were large regions of vegetation. Well, they're not. Whatever they are, they're not. It's not chlorophyll because they're not green. Okay, in any case, these areas then are gray and these areas are red, which means that if you take a picture of the planet in blue light, if you don't allow any red to go through, the dark areas are going to be about as bright as they were all along, but as they are in the red picture, for example. However, the red deserts are going to be dark as well. They are, in fact, as it turns out, going to be just about equally dark. And so if the picture in the upper left were honest, it would show a disk, all of which is just about as dark as these dark areas are in this picture. But if anybody took such a picture, they would have taken one look at it and said, we've underexposed. Take a little longer exposure. And so you take a longer exposure, and the uniform gray comes out as a uniform light gray, and that's what you're seeing up there in that picture. So it is simply a matter of no contrast between the dark areas and the bright areas in this blue picture. Now, that is a short version of what was actually a somewhat more complicated phenomenon. If any of you are interested in discussing it further, I'll be happy to in the question period at the end. For example, I don't know how much astronomy background many of you have. If you have quite a lot, some of you are sitting there thinking, wait a minute, what about the blue clearings and so on? And if you want me to get into that stuff, I will. But for the general lecture, what I just said is all that you need to know. Okay, so, well, all right, fine. So we used to think Mars had more atmosphere than it does, so what? Well, so what is it? It changed our entire notion of what the planet is like. Here is a beautiful painting that was done by the space artist, Chesley Bonestell, back in the 1940s, which very nicely summarizes in one painting the classical view of Mars. You are standing on the melting polar cap in spring, and of course the polar cap was believed to be frozen water, and it is melting, and there is liquid water which is running off through the canals toward the equator and irrigating the vivid green vegetation all around it, and life is coming once again to the Martian deserts. And we believed, in fact, that we were seeing all of this.
notice the clouds in the air, and notice the nice bright blue sky over that brilliant red sunset. And in fact, it is a, there was less, it was believed by this time there was less air than there is on Earth, and so you can actually see the Earth as that dot in the sky. Sorry, I've got a perfectly good pointer here. You can actually see the Earth as that dot in the sky up there, but nevertheless, there is plenty of blue sky. Well, that blue sky is actually the worst feature of the picture. I'm not blaming Bonestell, of course. It was perfectly accurate as far as anybody knew at the time. By the picture, I mean the classical picture that we had of Mars. That blue sky is the worst feature because that could be produced only by lots more air than Mars actually has. In fact, were it not for the dust in the air, the Martian sky would be practically black, just like the sky on the airless moon. Well, if Mars had more air than it did, then it would be warmer than it is. The effect of an atmosphere on a planet is to make that planet warmer than it would be otherwise. And that is a phenomenon called the greenhouse effect. An atmosphere acts exactly like a blanket. If you're sleeping under a blanket, an ordinary blanket, not the electric kind, it does not emit any heat of its own. And yet you're much warmer than without it, and the reason is that it traps the heat that is already there, the heat of your body, and prevents that heat from escaping into space. An atmosphere does the same thing for a planet. The most spectacular example of that is to compare the Earth and the Moon, which are both the same distance from the Sun. You'd think they'd be the same temperature, but in fact the average temperature on the Earth, which has air, is almost 100 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than the average temperature on the Moon, which has no air. And Mars, therefore, if it had more air, would have had warmer temperatures. Furthermore, there wouldn't be as much temperature variation, because the more air you've got, the more it smooths out the difference between the hot day and the cold night. And the spectacular example of that is Venus, where there's 100 times as much air as there is on Earth, 20,000 times as much as there is on Mars. Almost all of Venus's air is carbon dioxide, which happens to have a very, very strong greenhouse effect, much stronger than the nitrogen and oxygen that make up most of the air on the Earth. In fact, our greenhouse is due mostly to the tiny amounts of carbon dioxide and of water vapor in our own atmosphere, not the nitrogen and oxygen. Venus, with all that greenhouse effect, even though its night is 56 Earth days long, between sunset and sunrise, Venus is the slowest rotating planet in the whole solar system. During that entire 56-day night, the temperature, which is 900 degrees Fahrenheit on Venus, does not fall by more than 5 degrees. So you see, that's the effect that an atmosphere has on a planet. It's a big one. So, if Mars had more air than it did, then not only would the temperatures be warmer all over the planet, but there wouldn't be the big variations in temperatures between, for example, the pole and the equator, which actually occur, and those snow caps would have been frozen water, and not what they actually are with Mars's very small amount of air, which is frozen carbon dioxide, dry ice, precipitated from the air itself as it freezes in the Martian polar temperatures, which in fact are far colder than anybody knew when Bonestell painted this picture. They are 190 below zero Fahrenheit. There's an even worse problem. The air pressure on Mars is so low, as I explained in an earlier lecture, that liquid water cannot exist no matter what the temperature on most of the planet. And so, the polar caps are not melting, water is not flowing away from them through the canals or any other way. If the polar caps were made of water, and there is a small amount of water in the polar caps, and in fact, even in the summer, there's a polar cap made of frozen water that stays all through the summer, a small one, but to the extent that they are water, when they are heated up above the freezing point of water, they don't liquefy, they evaporate. You get water vapor in the air. So you see, every single aspect of this beautiful painting, made only a few decades ago, after all, is wrong, with the one exception of the red color of the deserts. Now, here's the one thing that you can see from the data that I've given you so far. Here are two pictures of Mars, in both of which the southern hemisphere is turned toward the Earth. The equator is running through about there. There is the dark area Meridiani Sinus. There it is also. Here is the dark area Aurora Sinus. Here it is also. I think you can see that they're a great deal different in the two pictures. And you can see that these are different seasons. Look at the polar caps. This is obviously summer, or at least spring. This is obviously winter, or at least very early spring or very late autumn. What I'm showing you is that the dark areas get a good deal darker and more pronounced and more obvious in the spring and summer, and then they become a good deal lighter and less obvious in the autumn and winter. and coupled with the supposed fact that they were green, and the supposed fact that in the spring the polar caps were melting and the water was therefore able to flow south toward the equator and irrigate the dark areas, the classical picture of Mars visualized those dark areas as vegetation. And these changes were supposed to be due to the seasonal growth and decay of vegetation, and you would see exactly the same sorts of things if you were looking at, for example, the forests of North America from space. So it was a perfectly reasonable assumption, but disastrously wrong. Probably, we don't know now, we've advanced the point where we don't know, we've advanced the point where at least we know we don't know why the dark areas are there and why the bright areas are there. The dark areas are not vegetation, and the belief at the moment, and this is a theory that Carl Sagan came out with just before Mariner 9, it looks as though it's been proved substantially correct, is that the dark areas are made of some darker colored dust than the bright areas, and it's entirely possible they're even made of the same minerals, and that simply the dark areas are places where the wind tends to concentrate dust particles of larger sizes. Any material, any rock that is ground up into a finer powder becomes lighter in tone. And that's the reason for the rays on the moon, for example, for those of you who know about those. It's entirely possible that these are simply places where the wind is not capable of carrying, is capable of carrying the larger particles, and out here the wind is capable of depositing only the finer particles. We don't know. In any case, what Sagan says the seasonal changes are due to is simply that in the Martian autumn, the winds change as they do seasonally on Earth, and they blow bright colored dust in from the bright areas into the dark areas, and then in the spring they change back as they do on Earth, and they blow it back again. Now that is obviously a very, very different picture from seasonal growth and decay of vegetation, and you'd think there'd be 87 different ways you could decide right away by observation between two such radically different models, and the only reason we can't is that we do have such a miserable view of Mars as seen from the Earth. By the way, I should point out that both of these pictures have been very, very severely exaggerated in contrast in order to allow you to see anything. In fact, there is not that much difference in brightness between the dark areas and the bright areas. It's not as extreme as it looks here. Okay, finally, let me tell you about the canals. Here is a photograph, and here is a drawing on the right of Mars made at the same time, and you can see that the observer was convinced that he could see more detail on Mars than could be photographed simultaneously. That was plausible for reasons that I've already told you. To give you an orientation, here is Syrtis Major, here is Hellas, which turns out to be the biggest crater known in the solar system, 1,200 miles across, and you can see that the observer has drawn a number of canals, for example, that one, and that one, and that one, even though they don't show up in the photograph. The canals are optical illusions. They are not the same as the great water-carved channels on Mars. And that is a mistake that has been made in quite a number of popular articles about Mars written by people who knew a little bit about it, but not quite enough. And they said that the canals turned out to be water-carved channels. That is absolutely false. The water-carved channels are not in the positions where the classical observers drew the canals, and they couldn't have been seen from Earth anyway. What the canals were supposed to be were these thin, dark lines, and they simply do not exist. What are they then? Well, here is a photograph of Mars, one of the very finest color pictures of the planet that has ever been taken. And one, in fact, that is so good that it's one of only a handful that actually show one of the classical canals. This is Meridiani Sinus, which I showed you two pictures back, Aurora Sinus here, and over there to the left you can see faintly but definitely a real live honest-to-gosh canal. And that is the one that was referred to as Agatha Demon on the classical maps. All right, let's see what it turns out to be. Here's a picture of roughly the same face of Mars. There's Aurora Sinus, Meridiani Sinus is out of view. And here is what Agatha Demon turns out to be. It's a number of dark spots. This picture was taken from a distance of about 500,000 miles by Mariner 7 in 1969. The closer pictures show that many of these dark spots are simply dark floored craters. And some of them, at least, probably all of them, are dune fields within the craters, where the wind has concentrated larger particles, sand-sized particles, as opposed to silt-sized particles, which are presumably the bright things. Anyway, you got a bunch of dark dots, which aren't even terribly well lined up, but they are sort of, and they become a little bit thicker and faster. But again, you can see if you look that this is really made of a number of dark dots, not particularly well lined up. But look at this region of Mars now as I blur out the picture to make it look as bad as our best pictures from Earth. You see the canal up here? All right. That sort of thing is all the canals turned out to be, and there is Agatha Demon. And if it still doesn't convince you as much as the last picture did, that's because I haven't made this picture nearly as bad as our best pictures from Earth. I can't. It's just too good, and it won't blur as much as I'd have to. That's what the canals turn out to be. That's one thing. And the other thing is this. You can see within the bright areas, there are some regions where there are fairly definite boundaries between areas of two different brightnesses. And there is a well-known illusion which has been observed in psychological laboratories that when you present the human eye with a case like that, it thinks that it sees a thin, dark line along the boundary when, in fact, there is no such line there. The combination of those two are apparently all the classical canals turned out to be. I think that this whole story is one that is important for you to know for reasons that are far beyond Mars. It illustrates very nicely the dangers of extrapolating to an entire model, a whole picture of any phenomenon, whether it's a planet or anything else, from a small database. And I can cite areas in science where we have enormous databases, and therefore where our conclusions are probably very reliable. For example, our present-day knowledge of much of Mars, things that I've already been telling you about. On the other hand, I can cite areas which perfectly reputable scientists are willing to give out very definite sounding conclusions about, where, in my opinion, the database is just as small and therefore is just as susceptible of being overturned by one new finding. That's all it would take. For example, the assumption that simply because there is life on the Earth, that life must be commonplace throughout the universe. We know so very, very little about life in the universe, about what conditions it requires, about how likely or unlikely it is to come into existence, about how likely it is to survive on a planet after it's come into existence. We know so very little about that, that I claim the only honest answer to the question, how likely is it that there's life common elsewhere in the universe, is we don't know enough to be able even to express an opinion. And if I could look ahead in the future, 100 years or so, and we'll know the answer, it would not surprise me in the least if it turned out that Earth is the only planet in the whole universe that has life. That some really special circumstance that we just happen not to have thought of has had to go so very, very right that only on Earth has it been able to happen in the whole universe. It also would not surprise me in the least to look ahead 100 years and find out that life is common and that every other planet has it and there's all kinds of variety in it and it happens all over the place. The point is, we simply do not know any more than, in fact, we knew about the surface of Mars 20 years ago. And the other thing that I want you to realize is that Mars is the best observed planet from the Earth. All of the others we have an even poorer view of, with the one exception of Venus, and Venus is totally cloud-covered, so we can't see anything on that anyway. And so, if we knew so little about Mars before spacecraft, think what the surprises are going to be when we get out of, for example, worlds in the outer solar system like Uranus and Neptune, not to mention the moons in the outer solar system, which we know so very, very much less about than Mars. I'll give you just one example of that. For years, the astronomy books have gone on quoting the rotation period, the length of the day, of the planet Uranus as 10.6 hours. That was based on a number determined back in the 1930s, more or less as a lark, by some astronomers who discovered, found they had nothing much else to do one night, and observed the rotation period of Uranus, and nobody had bothered to look at it since. Very recently, in fact last week, it was announced that a new rotation period has been determined, which may or may not be better. It is more than twice as long as the standard figure that is quoted. And if we don't even know of a quantity as fundamental as the rotation period of Uranus, what more do we know about the more subtle things? The atmosphere of Mars was studied by the Viking landers even on the way in. And of course, it's being studied by the orbiters as well. And I think that it's incredible. I told you how everything on Viking is used, including the squeal. I think that it's incredible that here we were making mankind's first successful attempts to land on Mars. Nobody knew whether we had any chance of doing it. And you had this enormously complex landing sequence going on. And on top of all that, they were willing not only to go through all the things they had to do for the landing, but to take very detailed observations of the atmosphere of Mars on the way down. and these are the data. We have been able to do this sort of thing from the Earth only very recently by sending rockets and then satellites up through the atmosphere in the other direction, and now we can do it on Mars, of course, coming in from the other way down. This is a profile which shows you basically the structure of the Martian atmosphere, and it turns out the best way to do that is to plot temperature as a function of height. And so here is temperature in degrees Fahrenheit for the entry of Viking Lander 1, which is shown in red, and Viking Lander 2, which is shown in blue, plotted against altitude in miles. There is the surface, where, as you can see, the temperature when they landed was a balmy 50 to 60 below zero Fahrenheit, and it got steadily cooler than that as you went up the first 30, 40, 50 miles until it was well under minus 200 degrees, and then it got, ignoring some rather large excursions back and forth, there is a region where the temperature is not varying, at least in any systematic way. It's not getting systematically colder as you go up. And then there is a region where, again, degrees. So, on top of all that structure, you have these wiggles back and forth, and you can see that there is quite a bit of disagreement between the two landings as to exactly where the wiggles go. That disagreement is real. That is not observational errors. It is because, partly, Lander 2 landed at a different time of the Martian day, 9 a.m. Martian equivalent time, instead of 4 p.m. like Lander 1. Partly, the Lander 2 landed at a very different latitude, 48 degrees instead of 22 degrees, but partly because there are differences in the atmosphere of Mars like this that happen all the time. I'll tell you about them in a moment. First of all, let me try to explain the reason for this general three-part division into a region of the atmosphere where it's getting colder with height, a region where it's staying roughly the same temperature with height, and a region where it's getting warmer with height. They are referred to, respectively, as the troposphere, the stratosphere, and the ionosphere. And so, if nothing else, you're about to learn what those terms mean. You've been hearing them all your life. Finally, somebody's going to tell you what they're about. The troposphere is the region in the lower part of a planet's atmosphere. In the case of the Earth, it goes up to about 10 miles altitude. In the case of Mars, you see it goes up to about 50, where the temperature is, in fact, falling with height. And if you think about it for a minute, that's really kind of a strange thing for the temperature to be doing. Little kids worry about this, and they say, why does it get colder as you go higher? You know, once they learn that it does, and of course, you know, everybody knows that it does. If you've ever been camping out west, you know, it's a lot hotter down in the valleys than it is up on the mountains the same day. Well, why does it get colder as you get closer to the sun? Which is the way little kids think of getting higher. And their parents say, don't bother me, kid. And that's the last you ever worried about it. But in fact, what's happening, obviously the fact you're getting closer to the sun is negligible, the distance of the sun being so great. What is happening is that the atmosphere, the lower part of the atmosphere of a planet, is not being warmed by the sun at all. The sunlight is shining through the atmosphere. The atmosphere is transparent to sunlight. Therefore, the sunlight is not being absorbed. Therefore, the energy of the sunlight is not being changed into another form, such as heat. And so, if the atmosphere is not absorbing the sunlight, it can't be heating. It can't be being heated by the sunlight. No, the atmosphere, the lower atmosphere anyway, is being heated by the ground, not by the sun. Because the ground is not transparent, it does absorb the sunlight, it destroys the energy of sunlight in the form of sunlight, but energy cannot be destroyed, it can only be changed from one source to another, it is changed into heat in the ground. And everybody knows this process, everybody knows that you hold out your hand in the sun, you get warmer. Well, the ground, being heated, radiates, it shines, it glows. It's just that it isn't hot enough to be glowing white hot or even red hot. It is at a temperature where it glows in the far infrared. And if your eyes could see far infrared, even if you were to turn out all the lights in here, you would think of all the walls and all the people in this room as glowing brightly. They'd be glowing in the far infrared, which of course are wavelengths the eye cannot see, because what would the use of it be? The eye itself is glowing in the far infrared. And so, if you could see far infrared, all you'd see would be a general haze in exactly the same way as if the inside of your eye were coated with the stuff that fireflies glow with and you were trying to see invisible light, you know? So that's the reason you cannot see that. All right, but nevertheless, the ground is emitting far infrared and the atmosphere is not transparent to far infrared. The atmosphere absorbs far infrared and, in doing so, is heated. So, here is the heat source. the ground. It's shining infrared up into the atmosphere and heating the atmosphere. Obviously, the atmosphere right next to the heat source is heated the most, and as you get higher and higher and higher, the amount of infrared that is making it through as you get higher and higher is less and less, because more and more has already been absorbed further down. And so, of course, the temperature is falling with altitude, until finally you get to a height where there is no infrared from the ground getting through, where it's all been absorbed below that height, and above that height, the temperature is not going to vary, aside from these wiggles, which I have to come back to. If this were a curve for the Earth, you wouldn't have the wiggles, and you would have a nice, simple decrease, and then a straight line with a complication that isn't on Mars, the ozone layer, which gives you a bulge, and then the ionosphere up above there. Well, what you've got here on Mars is this region where, aside from the wiggles, the temperature remains the same with height because nothing is happening there. No heat is being absorbed, and that is the stratosphere. This layer is called the troposphere, which means dust layer and dust sphere, and that is the layer in which, on both the Earth and Mars, weather occurs. Because if you have the temperature decreasing with altitude, that is opposing the tendency of hot air to rise and cold air to sink. And so the effect is you are going to have turbulence. You are going to have a continuous turnover of the atmosphere. And that is where the weather occurs. And if you have dust in the atmosphere, it's going to remain in this region where there is the turnover between the source of the dust, which after all is down in the ground, and the top of the region where there is turnover, where there is convection, and so this is called the troposphere. The stratosphere is called that, stratum means layer, because to a first approximation, there are no temperature changes in it, therefore there is no rising of warm air and sinking of cold air, and the air in that region simply sits there and stagnates, and a layer retains its composition and doesn't interact very much with the layer above or the layer under it. That's only to a first approximation. Nothing is as simple in meteorology as I'm making it out to be here. But to a first approximation, the stratosphere is stagnant, and so we call it the stratosphere. Finally, you get into this layer where the temperature is rising with height, and in fact, on both the Earth and Mars, if we could observe the extremely rarefied air more hundreds and even thousands of miles out, we would find the temperature was rising to thousands of degrees. However, the air up there is so very, very thin that although it is at a temperature of thousands of degrees, you don't notice the heat. And if you were immersed there naked, you would not boil, you would freeze. Nevertheless, the temperature, when occasionally an air molecule does go by, is very hot. And the reason for that is that the X-rays from the sun, which are absorbed by even a tiny amount of gas, therefore get only down to the very, very uppermost layers of the atmosphere, and they are absorbed. X-rays are extremely energetic. They knock electrons clean off the atoms when they are absorbed. This heats up that layer, and that's what you've just seen. But in addition, the electrons and the atoms which are left, the fragments of the atoms that are left, are both electrically charged. Therefore, there are layers up there which reflect radio waves, and now you know why the ionosphere reflects radio waves. It's all due to X-rays coming from the sun, which would be lethal if they ever hit us down here on the ground, but they don't. They are absorbed in the upper layers of our atmosphere, and they turn those into an ionosphere. All right, I've explained everything except these waves. Well, what's happening is that those literally are waves. They are thermal waves. They are waves of density, which are moving upward through the atmosphere in exactly the same way as ocean waves move up through the atmosphere. And as they move up through the atmosphere, they heat the atmosphere, and they heat it more where the waves are most intense. And so what happened was, Lander 1 was going through these waves and happened to hit most of them at different heights than Lander 2 did, and that's why the wiggles are in different places in the diagram. Waves like that are very interesting. One of the big mysteries of solar astronomy for a long time has been how it can possibly be that the atmosphere of the sun, particularly the outer atmosphere, the part we call the corona, is hotter than the surface of the sun, where the energy presumably is coming from. And in fact, the surface of the sun is the coldest part of the sun. It's only 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and the atmosphere is millions of degrees Fahrenheit. So how can this possibly be? Well, the standard theory is that it is heated by density waves like this, actual sound waves, which are set up by all the bubbling the turbulence, the convection on the surface of the sun, and they move out through the sun's atmosphere. As they move out, the air gets more and more rarefied, and that means that the energy of the waves becomes more and more condensed until they eventually, in the case of the sun, actually become shock waves. They move out and they heat the upper atmosphere of the sun. We have observed the same phenomenon happening in Jupiter, and now we are observing it on Mars. Meteorologists have asked themselves for a long time, why doesn't it happen on the Earth? The reason that it doesn't happen on the Earth is that there is that temperature bulge up here, the ozone layer, and the ozone layer, which you do not have on any other planet, because ozone is a form of oxygen, and there is no other planet where there has been so much photosynthesis that large amounts of oxygen have been released into the atmosphere. The effect of that bulge in the temperature curve is to isolate the waves down in the lower part of the atmosphere where there's all this turbulence and convection anyway, and so you don't notice them. And anyway, it's still relatively dense down there. There is lots and lots of energy to generate such waves in the lower atmosphere of the Earth. There are hurricanes and tornadoes, and even a common summer thunderstorm produces several times the energy of a Hiroshima-sized atom bomb. It doesn't do it as fast, so it's not as destructive. But nevertheless, the amounts of energy in the weather systems of the Earth are enormous. And until this whole thing was thoroughly understood just a few years ago, meteorologists really used to worry about that, because as far as they could see, there ought to be these waves. They should propagate up through the atmosphere of the Earth, and when you plug in the equations to the observed properties of the atmosphere of the Earth, they ought to be so intense that in the case of the Earth, they would heat up the atmosphere so much they would blow off the entire upper atmosphere into space. We still don't understand that whole matter in detail. And the whole question of the upper atmosphere of the Earth versus the lower atmosphere is one that has become very important in recent years. For example, the problem with the SST. The SST was going to emit substances into the ozone layer, and it would be flying in the lower part of the ozone layer, so it would emit them directly into it, and those substances would have, it was feared, attacked the ozone layer, which protects us from the ultraviolet from the sun, not the X-rays, those are further up, those are the ionosphere, but the ultraviolet, which is also dangerous, is prevented from getting through the Earth only by the ozone layer, and so the fear was that the ozone layer would get eaten by these substances produced by the SSTs, and as a result, at least in this country, we have no SSTs flying. Then a more complicated problem came up, freon. Freon is not emitted in the ozone layer, it's emitted down here in the troposphere, and then slowly, over decades, it works its way up into the upper atmosphere. What happens then? Can sufficient quantities of it get into the ozone layer to attack the ozone before the freon itself is destroyed? And we don't know the answer to that kind of question, and part of the reason that we don't know the answer to it is that our upper atmosphere is rather effectively decoupled from the lower atmosphere in the kind of way that I just talked about. And one way that we can understand such atmospheres is by studying atmospheres where it doesn't happen. And so here's a beautiful example of where Viking studies can help with a very current, practical problem of political import at the moment, namely the whole freon controversy. You compare a planet where you don't have the waves trapped inside the atmosphere with your own planet where you do, and you begin to get some insights about your own. Something else I should point out on the diagram, and that is the broadest division of all of a planetary atmosphere, into a region called the heterosphere on the outside and a region called the homosphere down at the bottom. If you think about it for a moment, an atmosphere is made of a number of different kinds of gases, and those gases are some light and some heavy. You would think that since this is gas and has no strength and it can move any way that it likes, the lightest ones would float up to the top, and the heaviest ones would sink down to the bottom in exactly the same way as cream separates from milk. And in exactly the way as I've described in an earlier lecture, the solid materials in the planets, back when they weren't solid, back when they were liquid, when the planets were liquefied, separated out. A process called gravitational differentiation. This has not happened in the bottom part of the atmosphere of the Earth. And the reason for that is that there is enough turbulence in the troposphere and even in the stratosphere to keep the air well mixed together. And so if a heavy gas tries to sink or a light gas tries to rise, it simply gets mixed back in with the rest anyway, and the composition, percentage-wise, such and such percentage of nitrogen, such and such of oxygen, such and such of argon, and so forth, the composition of the Earth's atmosphere is exactly the same to one part in 10,000. anywhere in the atmosphere of the Earth up to a height of about 50 miles. Above 50 miles, the turbulence is low enough and the atmospheric densities are low enough that the gases are not coupled fully to one another. They do separate out from one another, and above that layer, you find that there are differences in the composition of the atmosphere itself as you go further up. The very outermost layer of the Earth's atmosphere, which can be photographed in far ultraviolet from the moon and was during Apollo 16, is made almost entirely of pure hydrogen, the lightest gas of all. Below that, there is a layer that is almost pure helium. And below that, there are layers that are mostly nitrogen, layers that are mostly oxygen, layers that are mostly monatomic nitrogen, layers that are mostly monatomic oxygen, and other materials mixed in very different ways from the way they are on the Earth. The region of the atmosphere where the composition is all the same is called the homosphere. Homo means same. The region where the atmosphere differs, where it's divided into layers, is called the heterosphere. Hetero means different. The division between them is called the turbopause. In the case of Earth, it's about 50 miles up. In the case of Mars, as you see here, measured by Viking for the first time, it is somewhere, question mark, somewhere in the vicinity of 75 miles. And the problem is, it so happens there was one set of instruments that were intended for the very rarefied upper atmosphere, a different set that was intended for the lower atmosphere, and it so happens that they didn't completely overlap, and where they didn't overlap is apparently right around where the turbopause is. So we're not completely sure of where it is, but it should be somewhere around 75 miles high. I can't give you numbers for atmospheric compositions on Mars that are quite as dramatic as those that I just did for the Earth, where we really have layers that are dominantly made of gases completely different from the dominant gas at the surface of the Earth, which is nitrogen. Because you see, Mars' atmosphere is so overwhelmingly dominated by carbon dioxide anyway. Our atmosphere, the dominant component, is only 3/4 of it. On Mars, almost the whole atmosphere is carbon dioxide, and that's 95% of the atmosphere at the surface, that itself being a Viking measurement. However, it is still impressive that at the highest altitudes where the landers were able to measure, up there around 150 miles, the atmosphere was half nitrogen and half carbon dioxide. So you see there are big differences on the way in. Now please understand, any planet's atmosphere is strongly squashed towards the surface, strongly compressed towards the surface. Half of the Earth's atmosphere is within 3 miles of the ground, of sea level, which means that if you have flown in a jet airplane, certainly not an unusual circumstance, as far as your body was concerned, you were in space. The air, a mere 7 miles up, is so thin that you could not breathe it. Even if it were pure oxygen, you could not breathe it. The air pressure is so low. And now you suddenly understand the meaning of that little charade that they go through, hoping you won't know what it's about, and therefore start worrying. In the event of a sudden loss of cabin pressure, what they mean is, if they didn't have their own artificial atmosphere inside the body of that aircraft, just the way as you have to for a spacecraft, you would not be able to breathe the natural air outside the window. And that's the reason why they have that little oxygen mask, which they always claim will automatically come down in the event of, as they say, a sudden loss of cabin pressure. I always wondered whether it would, but I've never had the opportunity to find out, and luckily I never will. Therefore, when I talk about heterospheres and homospheres, you mustn't get the idea there's very much gas in the Martian heterosphere. There isn't. But as far as the amount of volume that it takes up is concerned, it's most of the atmosphere. Here is how the pressure varied on the way down through the Martian atmosphere. And I'm afraid I'm going to throw a lot of graphs at you tonight, and I have a nasty tendency, since I know what the graph means, I have a bad habit of not explaining it fully. So, for heaven's sake, if I go on to another slide and I haven't explained something, as you're seeing on a graph and wondering what it is, somebody scream at me. Don't wait for a question period at the end. You know, somebody say, hey, what does that mean? This is height in kilometers above the surface. And remember that 100 kilometers is about 60 miles, all right, so that's the scale. In other words, here is the distance from Ann Arbor to Detroit, like about so, about 80 kilometers. And here is the pressure measured on the atmosphere as Viking Lander 2 came in millibars. Now, you're not used to seeing pressure in millibars in your daily weather reports. You're used to seeing it in inches of mercury. But a millibar is actually a very useful number because it so happens the pressure at the surface of the Earth is almost exactly 1,000 millibars. nice round, easy number to remember. And so you see here that the pressure at the Martian surface, where Lander 2 touched down, was about, actually it's plotted a little bit wrong, it should be about 7 millibars. Right away you can see that it is 0.7% of the atmospheric pressure at the surface of the Earth. Now, this is a logarithmic scale. Here is a height. Here is the height where the pressure is just 1 millibar, 1/1000th as great as the surface of the Earth, and that is about 22 kilometers. Here is where it is 1/100th as great, 1/1000th as great, 1/10000th as great, and so on back. Okay? And what you see is that it varies in a rather monotonous way on the way down. That is, every time you go up another 22 miles or thereabouts, it has gotten to be 1/10 as dense as it was before. Or to put it another way, 90% of the Martian air is below 22 kilometers from the surface. I didn't mean miles, I meant kilometers. Let's see, 22 kilometers would be around 15 miles. So the air is mostly concentrated towards the surface, and you get phenomena in the upper atmosphere that are really bizarre by the standards of what you see down there at the ground. For example, when Viking Lander 1 came in, a similar graph like this was plotted. I haven't been able to find a slide which shows both of them simultaneously at the same scale, so I haven't been able to make one for you that shows them both. But take my word for it that when Viking Lander 1 came in, all of the densities were less by a factor of 10 in the upper 50 kilometers or so. And then they were the same the rest of the way down. In other words, there was 10 times as much air at, say, 60 miles up when Viking 2 passed through that than when Viking 1 passed through the same location. Now, that's partly because it was colder at 9 in the morning than at 4 in the afternoon, but that's not enough to compress the atmosphere by a factor of 10. No, the only possible explanation is that the entire outer atmosphere of Mars is capable of breathing, of pulsating, like a giant heart beating. And it actually is capable of compressing itself like an accordion 10 times or more, for all we know, as dense as it is at other times when it expands, also like an accordion. And who are we to say that a factor of 10 is the maximum range that it can do? You know, we've only got two sets of data points. We happened to come in at times when it was different by a factor of 10. Maybe if we'd come in at other times, we would have seen bigger differences than that. That probably strikes you as bizarre behavior, but in fact, the upper atmosphere of the Earth does the same sort of thing. Well, so much for the atmosphere, the upper atmosphere of Mars. Let's talk now about the weather at the surface. Here is a picture taken by Viking Lander 1 of the meteorology boom, and this is the device from which all of those Martian